Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Winter is coming, the snow, the gray, and the cold. And across this continent, people are settling in for a few months of moaning. But you might be shocked and you might take heart to know that outside, the world is still alive. Everything doesn't migrate or hibernate. All around us, animals and plants are thriving in the snow and the bitter winds. This hour on Point, noticing nature alive and well in winter. You can join us on air or online. How do you think of winter? What do you see when you step outside or look outside your window? A lifeless snowscape? Can you see life thriving around you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour in the studio is Andy Fenton, a botanist. He is the director of conservation at the Nature Conservancy's Boston chapter. Great to have you, Andy. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And joining me from Aspen, Colorado, Jamie Cundiff. She studies primarily small mammals and birds and is also forest program director at the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies. Jamie, so great to have you. Do you have snow out there yet?
We sure do. We're excited for ski season.
Glad you're here. So a lot of us pay little attention, Andy, to what's happening outside in the middle of winter because we often want to get inside, right? But as a botanist, how do you see nature in the dead of winter?
You know, I'm as guilty as everyone of spending too much time indoors in the winter and sitting in front of my desk and my computer screen. As a botanist, I love to look at trees, but I'm going to tell a quick story about something that happened to me last winter. I had an opportunity to go out into the forest with a professional wildlife tracker. And as most of us in the U.S. last winter experienced extremely cold temperatures, temperature was about 0 degrees, and we had just had a fresh dusting of snow, which is perfect conditions to find animal tracks. And to make a long story short, within 2 or 3 hours being in the woods, we found tracks for almost 20 species, fox, coyote, bobcat, 3 species of squirrels, mice, voles, fisher, mink, ermine, otter. And it really opened my eyes as to how much is going on around us in the winter and how complex and dynamic things are going on, even when it looks quiet and dead outside.
Jamie Cundiff, what are the benefits of winter for nature? Why is it good for nature?
Well, one of the most fascinating things that happens in winter is what goes on below the snow. There's a thriving world beneath the snow called the subnivian zone, sub meaning under, nivian meaning snow. And there's a thriving community of small mammals that exist, and the snow actually acts as a blanket. It insulates those small critters from the harsh conditions that exist above the snow. There's actually a temperature gradient that happens where it's colder above the snow, and the earth is providing radiant heat. This allows water to migrate upward in the snowpack and weakens that base layer of the snowpack so that animals can move around quite freely. And this allows those small mammals to thrive. And if it's a good winter with a good snowpack and those small rodents do well, that means there's a better food supply for those larger predators come springtime and summer. So it really goes all the way up the food chain.
So it's real life under those snow piles. Talk about some of the rodents under there, Jamie, that are forming tunnels and doing all sorts of things under the snow in that subnivian zone that you speak of.
Well, you know, the subnivian zone, when you get down to the base, it's these snow crystals that are very loosely held together. And because of that great surface area, it's an excellent insulator. You can have deer mice, voles, shrews. You have those shrews that are eating, you know, insect larvae or eggs all winter long. The mice and the voles are eating grass and seeds, and they are thriving. And they, in turn, support some of the larger mammals that are very active in the winter. I love to think about the fox with their thick coat that keeps them warm. Foxes are so cute because they have those big ears and those little noses. They use those big ears to actually hear those little critters moving beneath the snow. And then they pounce and dive into the snow with those narrow snouts they have and snap up those those little shrews and voles and mice.
Can you actually see clues that animals are moving around just below your tracks? Or is it just something that happens on such a small scale that you can't really see it?
Well, in the dead of winter, when snowpack is really thick, you can't really see or hear it. But say right now here in Aspen, our snowpack is just building up. So we got a lot of snow and then some of it has melted off. And I noticed even just outside my apartment this morning where that upper layer had melted off, you can see some of those tunnels.
Andy Fenton, what happens as plants prepare for the cold?
Sure. Well, one thing is when April comes along, we're so relieved. We see the buds finally arrive. But what I like to point out is that the buds actually came in last summer when the getting was good, when plants were making sugar and forming their buds. So the flowers and leaves of next year's spring are already out in your backyard.
So is that a strategy for successful reproduction, right, to get your offspring out there early?
Yep, to flower early, attract those pollinators, get the pollen out, and make your flowers and make your fruit right away.
What do you have in front of you here?
Sure. Yeah, I went out in my backyard this morning, which was good. It's what we're encouraging people to do on listening online, and I actually did it this morning. And I pruned a couple twigs and off of my lilac bush and my forsythia bush, which a lot of listeners probably have in their backyard. And if you do that, if you go outside and look at these all winter long, you see they're covered with buds. Inside those buds are the flowers, those bright yellow forsythia flowers for next summer, and the leaves that will come out too. If I pick one apart in front of me.
I see the green little piece coming
out. Exactly.
Right,
that's the leaves and the flower buds. And the same with lilac. Inside this quarter-inch lilac bud is the beautiful, eventually 6-inch long flower that you'll be smelling in just a few months.
So we think about that coming out in spring, but it's really now. It's been here for a couple months.
They're specifically designed to withstand cold temperatures.
And it will survive those cold temperatures.
Oh, yeah, year after year. They've got protective coatings, these scales on top of the buds.
So as fall comes, Andy, and the leaves start to drop, that's a water conservation strategy, is it not?
That is a key adaptation. You might not find that in southern climates, in the southern parts of the U.S. and in tropical areas. But in areas where liquid water is scarce in the winter, like it is in the North America, most of North America, the trees have to design a strategy to keep their water. And losing their leaves is the strategy they evolve, because when those leaves are on, the little holes, the stoma underneath the leaves, are what bring in the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere so they can photosynthesize. But they also lose water vapor through those same holes. So their strategy is drop those leaves, get rid of them in the winter, keep the water in the tree, in the roots, in the stems, in the twigs and buds, and then grow them back in the spring when they need them again.
And there's that little waxy coating?
Sure. Well, you might say, well, what about pine trees? What about spruce and fir trees?
Yeah.
They're green all winter. And that's their strategy to keep photosynthesizing, which they can do. And they're continuing to make sugar throughout the winter on warmer days. But they have to also develop strategies to keep that water in. So that's why they have rolled up leaves, little skinny needles. And they also have a waxy coating on top of their leaves. And you'll see that on top of these buds, too.
Hmm. Jamie Cundiff out in Aspen, Colorado. What are you seeing right now that's changing right before you that you notice that we might not?
Well, one thing that's always really great to look at are the birds. People think of birds migrating or flying south for the winter, but many birds are adapted to stick around all winter long. I always like to think about the chickadee, which is a very small bird, and how they deal with these harsh conditions of winter.
Jamie, let me play some as you describe it here. Here's a black-capped chickadee using the phoebe call during the cold season. Go ahead, Jamie, as we hear.
We always talk about that call saying cheeseburger when we're talking to little kids about bird songs. But those little tiny birds, most animals, when they switch from a physical reaction to keep warm, such as changing the surface area of their body, huddling, changing their location, there comes a point where that physical process switches to a physiological reaction, an involuntary reaction. In most mammals, the first step in that process is to start burning fat to produce energy to keep warm. But birds don't have that brown fat. So birds go straight to the phase of shivering. And shivering is an involuntary reaction to keep warm. And the colder it gets, the more those tiny little chickadees have to shiver. What this means practically is that means the more they have to eat. So on colder days, those little birds actually have to eat more. So those birds actually become more active as it gets colder. They may seem on those hyper cold days to be super hyperactive because they have to feed so much. That's why I always say a great way to connect with nature in the winter is to put out a bird feeder because it helps those little birds keep their energy up. And it's a great way to observe just how active nature is during these cold times.
So, Andy Fenton, do you tend to get a little grumpy in the middle of cold, like in the middle of winter, like the rest of us, and then think to yourself, ah, there's something good coming out of all this?
I'm not immune to that at all. And I have a story. There's you mentioned earlier, Jane, that winter has some benefits to nature. And one of the benefits is it controls parasites and predators of animals as well as plants. So we have an invasive insect that is devastating our hemlocks on the East Coast. It's got a funky name of hemlock woolly adelgid. It's a little aphid-like insect. People are familiar with aphids in their gardens, on their roses and other plants. It sucks the juice out of the needle of the hemlocks and can kill a tree in a couple of years. And we're losing entire stands. But what they can't stand is extreme cold. So I like to chuckle that when I was at the bus stop all last winter grumping along with my co-bus riders, that I had a little glint in my eye knowing that the adelgids were getting knocked back and stopping their spread from Massachusetts up into Vermont and New Hampshire. So, yeah, I'm happy with the cold weather.
We're talking about nature in winter and how we humans can take heart by stopping to notice all the life that's still around us, even on the grayest day or the coldest snap. We go out with a recording of birds at a feeder in a snowfall in Ipswich, Massachusetts. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're getting ready for the long winter months by learning how to look for all the life that continues around us, under the snowbanks, beneath the bark, by the water, under the ice. During the winter, the wolves of Yellowstone National Park thrive as the snow slows down their prey. You can join the conversation when you're not dreaming of a trip to Florida or Arizona. Are you paying attention to the life around you? What do you see and hear around you on these long, dark, cold days and nights? My guest this hour, Jamie Cundiff, Forest Program Director at the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies, and Andy Fenton, Director of Conservation at the Nature Conservancy's Boston chapter. Jamie Cundiff, talk about the wolves in Yellowstone. We just heard them. How are they preparing for winter?
Well, you know, I always, but when I start to talk about animals that have longer limbs, such as those wolves and the foxes, I like to think about how heat affects limbs. So I always like to use the analogy of a heating up a one-room cabin. If you're heating up a one-room cabin with a potbelly stove in the middle, it all heats evenly. But if you start adding long hallways with rooms at the end of them, those rooms have trouble getting warm from that stove. And it's the same thing for these wolves and foxes and coyotes that have these longer limbs. And they have some really amazing adaptations so that, you know, their toes don't get frostbite like we would if we were out in the snow. And so what happens with animals with long limbs in the winter is that their arteries and veins are right next to each other. And what it does is it conserves energy while still keeping oxygen flowing to those extremities. So when warm blood is flowing out from the heart in the arteries, it's being cooled by conduction from the cool blood coming back in the veins. And the cool blood coming back in the veins is then warmed up by the warm arteries next to it. So that way, it allows that those extremities in wolves and foxes and coyotes to stay cool and to conserve that energy while still maintaining oxygen flow.
Oh, that's fascinating. Luke here is in North Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Luke. Glad you called. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I'm from Utah, and it's a huge ski and snowboarding community. And some of the things I've noticed out there are like moose, deer, small birds. And I just want to comment on the beauty of it. It's one of my favorite experiences, actually. I was up skiing at a resort and saw a herd of moose sitting, you know, just being a herd of moose there. I was on the list, and I took pictures of it. And, you know, it's been one of my favorite memories ever since.
Luke, thank you. Thank you very much. Andy Fenton, let me get back to the plants for a minute. You talked about the waxy coating on them, the water conservation of the leaves that fall in the fall. Talk about a plant dying of thirst, not of cold, during the wintertime.
Sure. Well, our plants are really well adapted to winter conditions. Maybe even more so than they're adapted to some of the droughts and heat waves we're experiencing in the summer. So our perennial plants, our ferns and our herbs, asters, other flowering plants, die back to the ground, and they stay under that snowy insulation and leaf litter that Jamie was describing. So they benefit in protecting their long-term survival from that insulating layer as well. In terms of trees, as I mentioned, they lose their leaves, which is a mechanism where they could lose water. All they have to do is protect their sensitive living tissue from freezing. Most of a tree is actually dead material. The bark is not living cells. Most of the wood is not living cells. The only living cells are in these twigs and buds and right inside the bark. That's called the cambium. It's the living layer that makes a tree get wider year after year. So if they can protect those and keep those moist, they're going to do okay. The cells actually take on different characteristics in the winter to prevent them from freezing. So they get flexible membranes. The sugars increase as a natural antifreeze. So they're conserving water by the thick bark and the waxy coatings on the twigs and buds and by losing leaves. And that helps those living cells survive the winter.
Hmm. Let's go to Jim in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Jim. Welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have a question about coyotes.
Okay.
I'm in a kind of a fringe suburban area of Nashville, and we do have coyote dens that are we know about in the spring because the pups will respond to emergency sirens in the area and yowl, you know, in response to the emergency sirens. But I noticed there's a young bunch of coyotes in the vicinity right now, immediately before winter, and I'm wondering what that portends for their well-being. Are they not ordinarily born in the spring? And if so, then what would this mean, do you think?
Jim, thank you. Jamie Cundiff.
Well, I not knowing if they're pups or they're yearlings, they still may be rather small if they were born this last spring in their first winter. But coyotes are incredibly well-adapted creatures that do well through the winter, especially in those urban areas. You might find them, you know, kind of going through your trash, even if you're not careful. But they have a very wide variety in their diet, and they have that thick fur, and they should do pretty well through the winter.
Hmm. Let's just listen to some sound of the male emperor penguins in Antarctica, gathering in huddles of up to several hundred, shuffling in waves to the center with their newly hatched chicks between their feet. Talk about the strategies of those penguins, Jamie Cundiff.
Well, the penguins are really interesting. They will huddle in their groups, and actually it's the male that protects the egg all through the winter while the females go out and forage for food. And so a lot of animals use this huddling mechanism to deal with the cold. You know, some of our smaller rodents that are under the snow may build dens and huddle to stay warm as a response instead of trying to go at it on their own. And that's all a function of surface area. The name of the game to survive winter is to minimize the surface area that is being exposed to the cold, and that huddling mechanism is very effective.
Are you saying one species huddles together, or are you saying lots of different kinds of animals huddle together?
one species will huddle together. But it's interesting. In the winter, you see in certain animals, especially here in Aspen, when I look at the waterfowl, they're much happier to spend time together in the winter. They have kind of safety in numbers, and they all hang out as a group. Whereas in the spring, all of a sudden you see, say, the Canada geese splitting off into pairs and becoming very aggressive towards one another. So we see from penguins to birds, animals behaving in a much more communal fashion in the winter. You see the same with deer as well, and
well,
elk.
At this point, it's a good segue to our next guest. Alexis Billings is a PhD student, a researcher at the University of Montana's Division of Biological Sciences. She joins us from Missoula, Montana. Alexis, great to have you.
Well, hello there.
Your research has focused on how different species of birds and squirrels flock together and collaborate to survive during the winter. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So winter is kind of my time to shine. It is when all of my research takes place. And as Jamie said, a lot of the birds and squirrels are quite active because they have really high energy demands. And so what I do is I go out and basically look how they are cooperating in response to predation. Predation can skyrocket, actually, for a lot of the birds and squirrel species that stick around during the winter, just because there are less options than in the summer. So predation can be quite high, and so it seems that a lot of these birds are actually cooperating across species to avoid predation.
Mm. So here's some sound that you provided us from your bioacoustics lab at the University of Montana of different species of birds and squirrels mobbing a predator to protect each other. What's happening, Alexis? How do they do that?
So in that recording, there are two species of chickadees, black cap and mountain chickadees. There are Steller's jays. There's also red squirrel and red-breasted nuthatch. And so that recording was taken at a bird feeder outside of Missoula, Montana, in response to me playing a sharp-shinned hawk call. So they didn't even see a predator. All I did was just play the call, and all these different species started responding. And so the idea is that these mobbing calls, which is what those are all giving, are very harsh, and they're very easy to localize. And so the species are able to listen to one another to cooperate and actually go and harass the predator until it leaves the area, which is quite amazing because most animals, when they experience a predator, actually try to move away from the predator. But in birds, they actually go and approach and actually attack it until it leaves the area.
So they're alerting each other with a very specific sound that's different for different prey.
Not necessarily for different prey, but for different threat levels, yes.
Ah.
So they all have mobbing their own mobbing call. So the chickadees is a chickadee call. The Steller's jay is a wah call, W-A-H call. It's very harsh. The nuthatch has a yank call, Y-A-N-K. The squirrel has more of a chip-type call. And so they within these calls, though, they can make slight alterations that actually encodes for threat level. And so, therefore, the chickadees, if they start going off, they can encode for something that is a very high threat to them. And then other species that share that predator will be alerted and will also join in.
Let's go to Josh in Austin, Texas. Hi, Josh. Glad you waited. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ms. Jane. I had a question regarding you talking about putting out bird feeders. And I've heard in the past that there are some instances where it's harmful to the bird's migration instincts to put bird feeders out. And I'm wondering what authority and what website would be good to consult for guidelines on based on your geography when it's to put a bird feeder out and when to not.
When you should and when you shouldn't. Josh, thanks so much for calling. Alexis Billings, what do you think? Are there guidelines on this?
Yeah, so it definitely depends on where you are as far as what type of feeder you want to put out and what you want to put in that feeder. So I would say the authority that I use is actually the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell. They have amazing stuff out there about feeders and what to put in and what not to put in. So in general, you're not really going to want to put up a hummingbird feeder just because if that's their only source and you don't refill it, then they don't survive. However, most other birds that eat seeds, so the chickadees, out east, the tufted titmice, all that kind of stuff,
you're not really going to harm them. If you're only going to make it a little easier for them if you put out food, because they're able to still forage in other places. At least out here, come spring when the bears come out, you need to be very careful about your feeders. But mostly in the winter, you don't have too much to worry about. I will say, though, that if you don't want to feed squirrels, it is going to be a constant battle for you.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Andy Fitton, jump back in here. Talk about seeds. You're a botanist, but talk about seeds and how they survive the winter.
It's very interesting. A lot of seeds actually require winter to germinate in the spring. They need a process of cold to both break down heavy seed coats. This is true for some of the maples, for oak acorns, and also to stimulate the embryo, the hormones in the embryo to start germinating. So that's another example of where winter is crucial to the survival of these species. It's interesting hearing Alexis and Jamie talk, because we have some of the same species here in the East, from titmice to chickadees, and gray squirrels are actually a big player, and jays as well, in planting oak trees. They'll bury oak trees under the leaf litter in the soil, and they won't remember where all of them are through the winter, which is good for the oak trees. And some of those have the leg up of being in the soil and germinating early and becoming the oak trees that we see and appreciate in our parks and yards.
What strategies do insects have during winter to survive?
That's a great question, and it runs the full gamut. So we see a lot of insects simply choose to enter a different life stage. So they'll lay eggs and then die, and those eggs will overwinter. Or the larva will be the overwintering stage, life stage of the insects. So inside the bark of trees are living larvae, still doing their thing, eating the living part of the trunk of trees. Woodpeckers are very happy to find those, even through the winter, a great source of food. Occasionally, they'll overwinter as adults, and even on warm days, you can see insects in the north part of the U.S. In the winter. One insect is very interesting. They're called snow fleas. Now, they're not actually fleas, so you don't have to worry about yourself or your dog. They're actually springtails, but you can see them crawling around on the surface of the snow on sunny days in January and February. Mm.
Alexis Billings, Jamie was telling us earlier about the subnivian zone, this hidden world below the snow where the snow meets the ground. And I've read a little bit about small birds getting into that zone. Is that true? Can birds join that ecosystem?
I have not heard of that. Most of the there are some birds that are more probable to be found on the ground, such as dark-eyed juncos and stuff like that. But in general, the birds tend to kind of hunker down in the trees more than in the snow.
And so how many birds do not migrate? What percentage would you say migrate and what don't? How many stick down and stick out the winter?
I mean, it completely depends on the area. At least out here in the West, I would say that the most common birds, I would say that we retain about 50% of our birds, especially our common ones. The chickadees are here year-round. Nuthatches are here year-round. We have all of our woodpeckers are here year-round. A lot of our raptors stick around as well.
Mm. And squirrels, how are they managing through the harshness of the winter?
Well, so we have two types of squirrels. We have the eastern fox squirrel, which is a non-native squirrel, and they are doing just fine, mostly because they tend to be in populated areas and are fed mostly by humans. Our native squirrel, the pine squirrel or the red squirrel, also is doing very well. And as Andy was saying, they are one of those species that helps with seed dispersal. And so they feed on different pine seeds and actually go and cache them and bury them under the soil. They do have an amazing spatial memory and remember quite a few, but the ones they leave then have the opportunity to germinate.
Well, Alexis Billings at the University of Montana's Division of Biological Sciences, really appreciate your thoughts and time today. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
We go out here with the sound of red and gray squirrels eating peanuts, good old African peanuts imported by humans in winter. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're starting off this winter with the right attitude by taking stock of nature this hour, of the wildlife that is not flying south but staying right in your neighborhood, of the first stirrings of spring that amazingly are already getting underway right now at the beginning of the cold season. My guest this hour, Jamie Cundiff, a forest program director at the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies, and Andy Fenton, director of conservation at the Nature Conservancy's Boston chapter. Let's get a call in here. Amanda from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was calling because I'm originally from the interior of Alaska, and I've noticed that a lot of the animals that, as you go further up north, they're larger. As far as birds and many mammals. And I'm down here in Tulsa now, and I've noticed that there is a huge difference between the size of squirrels. The squirrels down here in the south, and as you go more south from Alaska, are huge compared to the ones that we have up there. So I was wondering if there is a specific reason as to why this might be, or if the seasons have anything to do with it.
Amanda, thank you. How about that? Jamie Cundiff?
Well, size is a really interesting concept because animals surviving in winter, again, it all comes down to surface area and managing heat production versus heat loss. Now, larger animals lose more heat by surface area because they have more surface area, so there's more space for that heat to go away, but they lose it much slower. So you can have a small animal with not much surface area, and it loses heat very fast, but those large animals lose heat slower. So there's a spectrum. It's a trade-off that comes with increasing size of an animal. So say if you have a moose, a really big animal, they lose heat quicker. I mean, they lose heat slower, but they lose more heat because of their surface area over time. So those larger animals tend to compensate for that by having that really thick fur, where those smaller mammals maybe don't have as thick a fur, but they lose less heat by surface area. Mm. Does that make sense? Mm.
Thank you so much for the call. Andy Fenton, you brought some birch seeds in with you today.
Yeah, I'm sure you wondered why I bought what looks like a pile of breadcrumbs in. And this is one of my favorite things to do in the winter in the forest or in the woods. Anywhere the birch grows, which is most of the U.S., whether it's gray birch, paper birch, yellow birch, their strategy for dispersing their seeds is to drop their seeds on snow cover and let the seeds blow across the surface of the snow. These seeds are about 2 millimeters across, and they have little wings on them, and they literally blanket and sprinkle across the entire forest floor. And you would never notice them unless you stopped, bent down, and said, what are those little brown specks? So that's a fun thing to do that I like.
Beyond the birch seeds, tell us what to look for. Take us back. Take us on a walk through the woods.
Sure. And the good thing about the winter is you can do this anywhere. If you live in a city, if you live in the suburbs, if you live in a rural area, first, like Jamie was saying, listen. There's a lot of bird calls. When I went out to pick these twigs this morning, I heard chickadees, robins, and jays just in my urban environment near Boston. And then snowfall is great because you're going to see tracks. I'm a tree person, as you know, and so I like to look at what the trees are doing. Are the boughs breaking because of heavy snow? In which case, they're going to open up habitat for new trees and plants and animals in the spring? Or are they solid and are they surviving well?
Jamie, what do you look for out on a walk through the winter woods?
Again, I always, the snow is just an incredible place, as Andy mentioned earlier, to look for tracks. And especially here in Colorado, but all across the country, if you're a skier and you're riding a chairlift, my favorite chairlift activity is to look down between the trees and see what kind of tracks I can see. And you can tell a lot about an animal from its tracks through the snow. Is it a stepper? Does it step through the snow? Does it hop through the snow like a snowshoe hare or a squirrel? Does it bound like a weasel, or does it waddle like a porcupine or a bear? And again, by just looking even not just at the shape of the track, but how they're positioned, you can learn a lot about that animal. Like the moose that were spotted in Utah that our caller mentioned, moose don't have the big feet like a caribou or a snowshoe hare or a lynx, but they're adapted that moose can step up and get their feet all the way up to their shoulder, and that's how they deal with the deep snow.
Here's a flock of winter wren in Utah gathering together for warmth in the winter and continuing to sing. Jamie, talk about the puffing up of sparrows that happens outside in the wintertime. What are they doing?
Well, you know, that's one of those physical adaptations or behaviors that animals can undertake to stay warm. They can fluff up their feathers, and by fluffing up their feathers, they're creating more surface area between their bodies and the outside world, and that keeps them warm. Humans employ a similar mechanism when we put on our down coats. We're mimicking those birds. One of my favorite things to think about in the winter is we think, oh, these poor little birds, it's so harsh for them out there. But we're thinking as humans, and humans are subtropical mammals. We will start shivering uncontrollably at 65 degrees. A naked human will start shivering at 65 degrees, whereas an Arctic fox won't get to that point until, you know, minus 40 degrees Celsius. So we come from a perspective of being subtropical. Our closest neighbor on that chart as to where we start shivering is the night monkey. So you can think of humans being the night monkeys. But these little birds and foxes and the little mammals under the snow, they exist on a different spectrum. And we borrow from them all the time in trying to stay warm for winter.
Here's Blake in Middlebury, Connecticut. Actually, Vermont. He's in Vermont. Blake, welcome. Hi. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just have a quick comment. I prune apple trees in the wintertime, so I get to be outside all day in the winter, which I enjoy. I'm out here right now, actually. And one of the things I think when people think about winter, they often think of it as kind of a monolithic time period. But in fact, it's very, very diverse from the start of winter to the end of winter.
Mm. True. Blake, thank you. Isn't that right, Andy?
It sure is. And as we've talked, there are things happening under the snow throughout the winter. Whenever it gets warm, things start happening. Insects are out. Birds are feeding on them. Trees are photosynthesizing. And it won't be long. I like to tell friends and loved ones that the days start getting longer in about 2 weeks, and when they get really depressed. And there's things the plants are going to begin sprouting early. There's a whole suite of plants called spring ephemerals that are that bloom before the leaves leaf out, or the trees leaf out, because they want to capture as much sunlight as they can. So they bloom in February, March, and they're gone. And they've done flowering by the time the rest of the spring comes. Trout lily, wild leeks, ginseng, and other plants like that love to bloom first thing in the spring. And our garden plants, crocuses and snowdrops, do as well. So just around the corner.
Here's Brian in South Hadley, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I just have a comment and a question. I remember when I was a teenager reading Walden and Thoreau on Walden Pond, and being here in Massachusetts, I have actually visited Walden Pond, walked around there in winter and summer, but I live in South Hadley, and you know, getting back to the other thing of bird feeding, we feed birds throughout the year, but we have a strategy for keeping the bird feeders out of reach of the bears during the summertime, but we're always curious about when the bears hibernate so that we can put the bird feeders down on the ground.
Bring it back out. Got it, Brian. Thank you. Any strategies, Jamie?
Well, it completely depends on where you are. We kind of had an interesting start to our winter. We didn't have much snow here in Aspen, and then all of a sudden we got a lot of snow at once, and now it's kind of tapered off. So here we actually had some bears sticking around longer than you might normally think, and it completely varies when those bears go into hibernation. And here in Aspen, we always like to wait and make sure they're asleep before we put our bird feeders out, so it completely varies by location.
Here's Bob in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Bob. Glad you called. Welcome to On Point.
I want to add something on a subject that's gone by.
Okay.
About huddling together for warmth. I live here in Buffalo, New York, where it gets very cold. And one of the homeless women who live in the neighborhood, her name's Rose, tells me about sleeping in her pup tent in the middle of the winter and the deer coming and laying right up against her. Her inside her pup tent, and of course the deer on the outside. But we do know that deer and humans will huddle together when it's extremely cold up.
Bob, thank you.
That's quite an image. What about turtles, fish, and frogs, Andy?
Take us again, as a botanist, I'm continually amazed and incredulous, maybe like our listeners, that these species, turtles, many frogs, actually go underwater, and turtles go into the mud at the bottom of ponds and rivers over winter. They barely are alive. Their metabolism slows way down. They're getting just a little bit of oxygen from around them. They're digesting some of their shell to bring calcium to into their system to mitigate lactic acid that builds up from not breathing oxygen. And they're surviving the winter for many months. My kids and I like to go turtle hunting in the around the Charles River near our home. And where do they go in the winter? Well, they're under the mud at the bottom of the river. It's pretty amazing.
Something that you can't see, but think about.
Yep.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. MJ is in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, MJ. Thanks for calling. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Just quickly, I wanted to know how climate change affects the dormancy of the winter.
Excellent point, MJ. Thanks. Jamie Cundiff, what do you say?
Well, there's an entire field of study called phenology, which has to do with the timing of things. We at Higher and High Elevation Aspen are very interested in this and are tracking this locally through a tool called our Forest Health Index that tracks how things are changing. So some things are changing in a very clear trend, at least here in the Rockies. We're seeing a dramatic increase in frost-free days and a dramatic decrease in extremely cold days, but we're really interested in how that affects timing. So if we have a particularly warm winter and, say, a plant or a shrub goes to fruit early, but the migratory bird that relies on that plant, say, arrives on time, but by the time they arrive, that plant, because of an earlier spring, has already bloomed. So we're seeing a mismatch in some food supply issues with plants. And so we're keeping a very close eye on that. I'd also encourage citizens across the country to record their observations. There's a great kind of wave of citizen science happening in crowdsourcing data. Some great ones are Project Budburst, which tracks when things flower, when the last leaf falls off a tree, and Nature's Notebook. Anyone can go online and record their observations to track how these things are changing.
Mm. Jamie, thank you.
Yeah, Andy. That's a great example that Jamie brings up. The other thing that can happen is if plants bloom too early and then we get a refreeze, then we lose the fruit for that year. That can happen to reduce acorns and other fruits for animals. So it can create mismatches and challenges.
Here's a snowy owl chick calling for its mother during the winter. On that note, let's go to Dave in Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the program.
Hi Jane.
Hi.
Thank you so much for taking the call. I had a couple of comments. One, I look for boreal chickadees when I'm riding the ski lift.
Yeah.
One place around I can see them. They're a little tiny bird, lovely, and they're there. And then the other was about at my bird feeder this fall. Starting in mid-November, I begin to see dark-eyed juncos, which disappear about March, April. They come back mid-November to December, and I got about 20 of them that come around, along with the usual characters, chickadees, titmice, downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, red-bellied woodpeckers, and a couple of cardinals. Mm.
Great images, Dave. Thank you. Let's go to Robert in Columbus, Georgia. Hi, Robert. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about some of the winter-active amphibians and reptiles. There's some of the lesser thought about animals that are active this time of year. Mm. And here in the southeast, we have the federally endangered indigo snake, which is a winter breeder. And this is a great time to get out and see if you can spot those. Mm. And also some of the tiger salamanders and gopher frogs, which are also in need of protection. Mm. This is a great time to get out and see some of those out on the crawl, making their journeys to their winter breeding pools.
Sure is, Robert. Thank you. Let me ask my guest moving out here. Robert set us up perfectly. What should we be looking for as we head into winter here and may not be aware of, but should see? Andy?
Yeah, well, You know, I learned to identify trees by just looking at them in the winter, which most people think, well, how can you tell tree difference between one tree and another? The buds and twigs are actually more characteristic, more diagnostic than the leaves, which are very variable. So back in the day, I learned 400 species of trees and shrubs just by their winter buds in a three-month semester. I'd say get close up, look, get your kids out there looking close up, and there's a lot to see by just stopping and smelling the roses, even when they're not blooming.
What would you say, Jamie Cundiff in Aspen?
Well, one of the great things we like to do here in the Rockies is look at the aspen trees when they are in winter without their leaves. And aspens have adapted to high elevation. If you take your fingernail and make a small scratch in the thin white bark of the aspen tree, you'll see a green layer underneath that is photosynthesizing even through the winter.
Beautiful images you've created for us today in our mind's eye. Jamie Cundiff, Forest Program Director at the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies. Thanks so much, Jamie.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Andy Finton, Director of Conservation at the Nature Conservancy's Boston Chapter. Terrific to have you with us, Andy.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Listeners, thanks so much for your input as well. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.